Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Jordan is Nicholas Hara, who is an analyst with the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Jamestown Foundation, and a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in the Jamestown Foundation's publications, among other publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Hara.
Thank you for having me.
And there has been, of course, the bombing of the Iranian embassy in Lebanon, in Beirut. Already the Iran's foreign minister has blamed Israel for the attack, but the Syrian government statement blames Saudi Arabia, quoting, "Each of the terrorist attacks that strikes in Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq reek of petrodollars." It's pretty clear what they're saying there. So just to start with this, I know we're going to be talking about the Kurdish region and the war within a war that's going on amongst the rebels in northern Syria. This seems to be like the southern front. I mean, this is an extremely complicated mosaic, is it not?
Yes, it is. The attacks today on the Iranian embassy are probably the most blatant statement by forces against the al-Assad regime and its allies, Iran and Hezbollah, that has occurred since the bombings over the summer in the southern Beiruti suburbs of Dahia, a traditional Hezbollah stronghold where many of the party's constituents live. Soon after the attacks, a Sunni Islamist armed opposition group, which claims to be based in Lebanon, the Abdullah Azzam Brigade, stated it had made the attack in order to force Hezbollah to withdraw its fighters from Syria, which have been fighting in support of the al-Assad government. These attacks are again aimed at areas that are considered core support for al-Assad, but how much impact they'll actually have on the fighting on the ground in Syria is questionable. Right now, Hezbollah is reported to be assisting the Syrian army in many key strategic areas of the fighting in Syria, particularly a range of mountains and badlands north and northwest of Damascus called the Jabal Kalamun. And the importance of this area is that it lies on the strategic M5 highway, which connects Damascus, still the capital of the al-Assad government, to its core areas of support in the western governorates of Syria, such as Homs and Latakia and Tartus governorates, where a majority of the Alawite minority support lives for the al-Assad government.
And I was just going to mention, Nicholas Hara, that the Iranian cultural attaché at the embassy in Beirut, Sheikh Ibrahim Ansari, apparently is among the dead. But the point that you're making is, I guess, that the al-Assad regime, with the help of Hezbollah, are rolling back a lot of the gains of the rebels and more isolating the rebel enclave in the Damascus suburbs.
Yes, and in fact, the reason, part of the motivation for this attack on the Jabal Kalamun area has been in order to do exactly that, is to isolate some of the more formed opposition groups, particularly the Islamist Liwa al-Islam and its sometimes allies, the Al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra, and other groups such as the militant Salafist armed opposition group Ahrar al-Sham, from being able to strike at the M5 highway, which has been a target for the Syrian armed opposition groups since at least last summer. The fighting in the Syrian town of Al-Qusayr, which concluded in June, which was at the time considered the most highly strategic town, which lied near the M5 highway, which ended in a victory for Hezbollah, it's in the Syrian military, and militias drawn up under the National Defense Army, which are local defense units that, if not in support of the al-Assad government, are at least tolerant of the regime and are fearful of the alternative being on the armed Islamist opposition groups. And this offensive, which has been described as being in a slow burn, is now seems to be flaring up. And the result has been a large number of refugees from Syria coming into Lebanon. Some recent figures suggest that you have upwards of 18 to 30,000 refugees that have fled into Lebanon from the area of Jabal Kalamun over the weekend. And the fight in that area in many ways is an existential battle for the armed opposition. It has been trying unsuccessfully for over a year now to cut off Damascus from what is considered the core heartland of the Syrian government support. And it blames Hezbollah, which many Hezbollah-controlled areas are contiguous with this region of Syria, for extending the life of the al-Assad government.
Again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Herra, who is an analyst with the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Jamestown Foundation, and a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in the Jamestown Foundation's publications, among other publications, and we're talking to him from Jordan at the moment. So I wanted to talk to you, of course, about the war within a war, particularly that's gaining momentum in the northern area of Syria, and also the movement on the part of the largest Kurdish group, the Democratic Union Party, the PYD, who have raised the stakes in this very complex and tortured civil war, or civil wars and wars within wars, declaring this area Western Kurdistan. And of course, this is where Syria produces a lot of its oil. So let's go through these. We've talked about what's happening in the south and the reverses on the battlefield that the Syrian rebels are undergoing. Let's talk now about the war within a war, because I don't know whether you saw the 60 Minutes piece recently with the American journalist who was captured by some of the al-Nusra Salafist groups, and it was pretty chilling how they moved him around in convoys with two suicide bombers assigned to him with their fingers on the trigger. They ran into a convoy, apparently a Free Syrian Army convoy. There was a shootout amongst them, and this American journalist was expecting to be blown up at any moment. And then you hear recently of a rebel executing and beheading a wounded rebel. We thought it was, in a rebel hospital, but this rebel was apparently reciting a list of, he was delirious and wounded. He was reciting a list of Shia shrines, and they assumed that he was an Alawite and just beheaded him. And then after holding his head aloft and shouting Allah Akbar, somebody noticed the head belonged to a fellow rebel, Sunni rebel leader. So this is all to say, this is a really grim and disgraceful and disgusting situation. And how could it have gotten, how could it have morphed from a popular revolution into this kind of nihilistic bloodletting?
Well, there have been a lot of accusations, and this is a very important point, is how did this conflict move from what at first appeared to be one of the shining moments of the Arab Spring, a push for reform and at least somewhat loosening of what had been fairly closed Syrian society, at least socially and politically, and into this harsh sectarian war. And there's a lot of evidence that both sides are to blame. We have evidence from activists on the ground. We have evidence from people who have been covering the conflict since the very beginning that there had been the attempts by the al-Assad government through its Mukhabarat, its secret police, and through gains that were raised, criminal gains such as the Shabiha, which were predominantly Alawite and sectarian orientation, but included others, including Christians and Sunnis, and in some areas were there other minorities such as the Druze, which are a religious minority, to attack protesters and to try to stir up sectarian sentiment and to point to graffiti on the walls that declared that the Christians would go to Beirut and the Alawites would go to the grave. On the other hand, there had been evidence from research that had been done prior to the Syrian civil war and also as the conflict went on that there had been a latent angry presence within certain Sunni movements within Syria against not only the al-Assad government, but against Alawites and other minorities in general, and that as the conflict wore on and as soldiers and police fired on peaceful demonstrations, and as killings occurred, and as tension started and flared up on village-to-village level in many areas of the country, that the conflict had a logic of its own. And that as foreign fighters became involved through organizations such as Jabhat al-Nusra, now most strongly with the Islamic State of Iraq and in the Levant, the fighting has gone so far, the militarization of sectarian and ethnic minority communities such as Christians, such as Alawites, which many of whom are being raised in local defense units called the Popular Committees, which are armed and funded by the Syrian government and which have received training from the Iranian Revolutionary Guards and from Hezbollah and from the Syrian military, that the fighting has become so existential that neither side, whether it's the Al-Assad government, whether it's regime-tolerant communities, maybe not they may like Bashar al-Assad, but they don't trust the armed opposition. And the fact that the general weakness of free Syrian army, you know, the Western backed or the Western hoped for successor military and security force in Syria, the Free Syrian Army, organized under the Supreme Military Council, these armed opposition groups' general weakness vis-a-vis the more hardline Islamist groups has made this really an existential struggle. Neither side, the Bashar al-Assad government or the most powerful armed opposition groups, which happens to be ideologically Islamist, many of the militant Salafists, have any reason to stop the fighting, because neither side at this point can really hope for much out of a transition.
So, and my understanding, Nicholas Harrah, is that there was an important rebel commander that was killed in a Syrian airstrike. He was with the more secular forces, but apparently he also came under criticism from his own ranks because he was trying to negotiate and navigate with the Islamists. And that sounds, a really grim activity, isn't it? I mean, it seems like the Salafist groups, the concept of negotiation and compromise is completely foreign, right? They are, for all intents and purposes, fanatics.
Particularly with groups such as the Islamic State of Iraq and Lebanon, and even against other hardline Islamist groups, over the past late April and May, there was several reports of conflict between the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant in Jabhat al-Nusra, its nominal ally, and there had been an attempt on the life of Jabhat al-Nusra's commander, Abu Muhammad al-Julani, by the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant, to the point where the spiritual head of al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, had to intervene and had to basically tell them, tell the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant recently, you focus on Iraq, Jabhat al-Nusra focuses on Syria. And this tension between Islamist groups, not just the ISIS, Islamic State of Iraq and Levant, and Jabhat al-Nusra, but also other militant Salafist groups, such as Ahrar al-Sham, the Free Ones of Syria, which is another extremely powerful national militant Salafist armed opposition organization, which cooperates with Jabhat al-Nusra. Now there are serious reports that those two groups are cooperating against ISIS and other Islamist armed groups. Their weakness within each other, within themselves, weakens their front against the government, the military of Bashar al-Assad. And the Syrian military, while it's been making recent gains, it in and of itself is not powerful enough yet to win on every front. A lot of these gains against the rebels have occurred because of weakness within the rebels' unity. And the fighter, the commander you were talking about earlier, Abdul Qadir al-Fellah, who is the leader of Liwa al-Tawhid in the area of Aleppo, was somewhat of a folk hero. While there was criticism of him of at times being almost too conciliatory towards groups such as Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS, all reports indicate that he represented a very powerful strain of ideological and military support amongst the armed opposition communities. That is, many areas of Syria, such as those areas in Aleppo and around Aleppo, which are predominantly Sunni, tend to have a local social cultural bent towards Sunni Islamism. And now, most often the case, it's not all the way towards hardline Salafism, but it is there. It is more conservative form of Sunni Islam. And long-running problems with the Al-Assad government flared up over the course of the conflict. And that's what makes Abdul Qadir al-Fellah's death particularly hard-hitting for the rebel movement, is that Aleppo is, in many ways, its most important front, with the Kurds consolidating the strength in the northeast, with the area in the far eastern city of Deir ez-Zor being a confusing and oftentimes conflicting mix of patchwork government control, local tribal militias, al-Qaeda affiliate groups such as ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra, fighting it out for control of oil and for control to access to border points. And with the southern front in the area of Deraa being weakened and predominantly under the command of the FSA, the front of Aleppo is very important. And Abdul Qadir al-Salah represented perhaps the most important, or certainly one of the most important people and figures that could hopefully, from the perspective of the rebels, bridge some sort of consensus to at least share their resources, coordinate their movements, and try to push back the al-Assad government's recent offensive. And now there's going to be less coordination, there's going to be less alliance building, and you'll probably see most of these armed opposition groups seeking to consolidate their power wherever they happen to be powerful. And we could be seeing the start of the separation of areas of Syria that are already under armed opposition control into small fiefdoms.
So just in the last minute or so then, Nicholas Herrer, my understanding is that the Assad regime has actually gone after the more secular groups, the more Free Syrian Army groups with greater firepower, and haven't pursued the Salafist groups quite as zealously, because the Salafists, Saudi-backed, Qatari-backed, and frankly, I find it very hard to understand how Saudi Arabia, that is a very tightly run country with a very strong secret police and religious police as well, why they continually say, well, I'm sorry, we can't stop the flow of money. This is just private money. This is not official state money. It seems very inconsistent that the state, such a tightly run state, can't control the outflow of money. But that aside, it seems that the whole idea of these Salafist groups and their backing from Saudi and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf has played right into Assad's hands.
Yes, it has. And it's also, and that's an important point to raise, because one of the most powerful armed opposition groups in Damascus, the capital, Liwa al-Islam, which is the focus of the current Syrian military and Hezbollah offensive in that area, the Jabal al-Mun, north of Damascus, has reports of having strong ties with Saudi intelligence. And some estimate that it's received millions of dollars in financial assistance from the Saudi government and Saudi intelligence. And this axis, the Syrian government under Bashar al-Assad and Hezbollah under Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, consistently made this point throughout the conflict. They've created a narrative of resistance. And their narrative of resistance, which before had been part of an axis of resistance with Iran and at one point Hamas and other concerned parties, had always been aimed towards Israel, towards confronting Israel, towards hope winning back Jerusalem and all the way into Palestine and forcing back the Israeli foe, has now shifted to a new narrative of resistance. And this narrative of resistance isn't necessarily new. Bashar's father, Hafez al-Assad, during what some could argue credibly was an actual civil war from 1976 to 1982, where the militant Salafist Fighting Vanguard group actively waged attacks against the Syrian military, which is military, and also members of the Ba'ath Party that it perceived to be part of a corrupt Alawite-dominated government, the precursor in many ways to Arab fighters that would go and join Osama bin Laden's movement in Afghanistan, and then the precursor to all these hardcore militant Salafist movements that we see now today in Syria as history turns again. This narrative of resistance that's been cultivated by Bashar al-Assad, a reinvention of his father's narrative of resistance, which has been added to Hezbollah's narrative of resistance, now focuses on these militant Salafist groups and aligns them as the main dagger being wielded by a conspiracy of Gulf Arab, Sunni Gulf Arab monarchy states, the United States and the West writ large, and Israel, in order to defeat the axis of resistance and to weaken or destroy their ability to confront Israel and to confront what they implied the government of Bashar al-Assad, Hezbollah, and the Islamic Republic of Iran as imperialism. And this is an important point because going along with sectarian community fears, the fears of communities such as Christians, the fears of some Sunnis who do not trust the more hardline elements in the armed opposition, other communities such as the Druze and the Alawites, the minority Alawite community, which the Al-Assad regime draws Tartar core support. These fears very neatly neatly go along with this renewed sense and this renewed message of resistance narrative against a foreign conspiracy wielding militant jihadism to destroy what had been a secular Syrian regime.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Nicholas Harrow. We haven't even got to the even further complication of what's happening in the Kurdish area of Syria, which is similar to what happened in Iraq 10 years ago, where the Kurds sense an opportunity to right old wrongs and reverse the Arabization and, of course, seize the oil reserves. This has even prompted the Barzani, the head of the Kurdish autonomous area of northern Iraq, to accuse the Syrian Kurdish group PYD of being in league with Assad to wreck a golden opportunity for Kurdish unity in Syria. So that is a further complication we don't have time to discuss. But I really appreciate you joining us here today from Jordan, Nicholas Herra.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Herra, who is an analyst with the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Jamestown Foundation, and a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in the Jamestown Foundation's publications, among other publications, and he joined us from Jordan. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the hollow nature of the Saudi regime's claim that it can't stop the flow of private money to fund al-Qaeda-affiliated groups in Syria.